because dying with the most toys is not the goal of life. The goal of life is to learn as much as you can, to do as much as you can, to be as much as you can, to experience the mortal existence. And by doing that, you'll have a lot more satisfaction than if you have a perfect 401k and a perfect house and two new cars, I promise you. It works for good or for ill. If bad people understand this principle as well, and they can manifest great power and great oppression on people by using this energy to manifest their kingdoms. Why do you think one illiterate tyrant can have so much power? Because there are lots and lots of people that are aligning their consciousness with his, and it's creating this resonance in the universe. I observe that society as a whole is all too willing to abdicate the responsibility for their own life condition to someone else. And that puts us sometimes in a bad position.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we have Brooks Agnew coming on the show. He is a scientist, a physicist, a chemist. He's taught at the university level. He's worked with all sorts of labs and Fortune 500 companies doing all sorts of incredible work. He's written 6 top-selling books that you can get on Amazon. He just expands your mind in a lot of things that he works towards and does. Very fun for me to talk to. It was really fun. His political persuasion is libertarian, and he's pretty strong and libertarian-minded person. But when it comes to physics and chemistry, he's really mind-expanding. So this is a 2-part episode. The first part is more physics, chemistry, science, history, and talking about a few of the books that he's written in those realms. And then we get into his latest book on the Clinton crime cabal. Very interesting. It's more political conversation versus a science and science, chemistry, mind-expanding talk, although it's kind of mind-expanding too when he starts talking about the syndicate and how that works and how it works in our country and how it affects politics. Very interesting show. And before we get into that, I want to thank everyone who's a patron of the show. I thank you so much. It really helps the show go and it keeps it going, and so I really appreciate it. And I now accept cryptocurrencies as well, and I have the link below so you can donate that way or even one time by PayPal. Thank you so much for keeping the show going. I appreciate that. I also want to talk about a series that's going on where you can grow your own food, learn how to grow your own food in less than an hour a day. Very interesting information on that. I have the link below. You will learn how to, for your family, be able to provide way more nutritious food than you can ever buy in the store. And they're trying to motivate you to be able to do it in less than a day. And I'm pretty interested. I want to move away from the cold climate and be able to have a garden all year long and have fresh vegetables and way more nutrients. But anyways, let's get into that show now with Brooks Agnew. Hi, Brooke. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Good to see you again.
Thank you so much for joining. You have this mind-expanding background. I mean, you've done these books. I want to talk about some of these books that you've written. You have so many projects that you do, but they're all so mind-expanding. And so I want to talk about a few of your books and then get into some of your projects that you're working on. But let's start with the book. It was called Remember the Future. And it's based kind of on the idea of the secret, but you put science behind that. Can you explain it?
Yeah, when I finished volume 3 of the Arc of Millions of Years series, one of the things that came out in the study was that these ancient civilizations were looking at the relationship between, let's just call it, human consciousness and the manifestation of what they wanted to accomplish in physical life. Now, they really didn't understand the principles behind it, but they knew that when they applied themselves, strangely, the universe seemed to line up with what they wanted, whether it was rain or whether it was, you know, softening the hearts of their enemies or whatever it was. In a lot of ways, they tilted it toward religion. But in reality, what they were doing is accumulating that human consciousness and delivering it with an intention. So along comes this book called The Secret, which is written by Rhonda Byrne. It started out with a good premise. They gave away 100,000 copies of the book, which is how it got into Oprah's hands, which is how the original interview occurred with Rhonda Byrne and Oprah. And the rest is, you know, book sales history. Now, the premise was that you could take a picture of what you wanted to have or accomplish out of a magazine, and you could stick it to your refrigerator. And every time you went to the fridge, you'd look at it and keep it in the forefront of your mind. And just by focusing on that, it would happen. And what happened was, you know, real estate agents, car salespeople, bankers, all kinds of people covered their fridge with their intentions. And then a strange thing happened. Almost nothing. And I thought to myself, why didn't that formula work? Why, you know, focusing on that thing, that motorcycle or that house or that husband-to-be or whatever, why didn't it work for them? And I started coupling it together with what the ancients were saying. And I said, at the time I was teaching university math at night, students that wanted to go and get their associate's degree and adults were in my class. So I got to the section in the book that dealt with Fibonacci, who was an Italian philosopher slash mathematician. He discovered a progression in numbers where nature seems to get its formula for division. So it's like 0, 1, and then 0 plus 1 is 1, and then 1 and 1 is 2, and then 1 and 3 is, you know, and 4, and it continues that way. So I didn't want to teach the progression that way because they would just learn it, take the test, and never apply it again as long as they lived. So I was sitting around with a calculator one night, and I said, well, what if we just take two random numbers, one odd, one even, they're not divisible by each other, they're related to each other in any way, and let's add them together. So that's the first two numbers, and then take the result and add it to the second, and the result and add it to the third, and so forth. And by the time I got out to the eighth iteration, you could divide the seventh number into the eighth number, and you got the golden mean, 1.618:1. I said, there's no way. I just lucked out on that. Tried another number, and it worked. Then I said, well, if it works with whole numbers, maybe it will work with decimals. It did. And then imaginary numbers, and then formulas, and then all these things mathematically progressed to the golden mean, which is the resonance of increase in the universe. Everything from protons to the periodic chart to solar systems to DNA, everything lays out on that golden mean. In nature, if it doesn't lie on that golden mean, it creates a dissonance, and unless you keep pouring more energy into it, it will fall apart. So when we look at our universe, in fact, my friends and I were sitting around one time going, what are the odds of a carbon-based universe? And they were calculating all these numbers with hundreds of powers of 10 to them. And I said, wait a minute. You know, a proton is the basis for our universe, a proton and an electron. Everything in the universe is based on those two particles. Protons are the same here as in the furthest reaches of the universe. And the truth is that we don't really know what a proton is. We know basically the quarks and things that make it up, but we don't know how a proton stays together virtually forever. And protons are different. Like a hydrogen proton is very heavy, an iron proton's relatively light. Still a proton, still chemically exactly the same. So there's a holographic difference between the two. Some mass is missing between the hydrogen proton and the iron proton. In fact, that's how fusion works. That's how the energy E equals MC squared. That's why that works. So all these things are rushing around in my head, and I go to teach this to the adult class, and I have an epiphany. If it works with whole numbers, decimals, fractions, imaginary numbers, functions, it must work with energy. This is how energy comes together in the universe to resonate, to make a proton, to make something that will last forever. So if it will work energy to mass, maybe it will work energy to a future. So, of course, being in physics most of my life, time is not really linear to us. We don't consider it that way in our thought experiments. And we don't think that it only goes forward, it also goes backward. And we also, almost universally, do not agree in a now, because we can't quantify it. We can't locate it in space. We can't tell how fast it's going. So as far as we're concerned, it's immeasurable. Therefore, it doesn't exist.
Now is infinitively small. Infinitive. It's an infinite small number to a point where it doesn't exist. There's only past and future.
Right. But if you want to look at it as a timeline, it is not two-dimensional. It is three-dimensional. So I, in the book, draw a funnel. I wish I had one I could show you. But you have the small neck of the funnel, and it kind of flares up a little bit. And then it gets to the opening of the funnel, and it flares out, right? Now is right at the neck of that funnel. That's where we are. The future is kind of expansive, within limits, because of the choices that we've made in our lives. The past is not a two-dimensional line. The past has some choice, has some realm of movement inside that neck. So when we go to the past and we reobserve it, we can clear away scripts that we've built for ourselves that make us have these bad habits over and over and over again. We can change the way the past affects us. Like, you know, you failed the fourth grade. Well, that's with you for life, but you can go back and relive the fourth grade over and over again and learn all that stuff, right? So then the effects of the fourth grade are eliminated, and it works with all kinds of things. The past actually changes for you.
How do you relive fourth grade?
It takes meditation, and you can take it by moments, not the entire, you know, 225-day school year. But you can take it by moments, those things that you remember that really affected you, like you had a bad teacher or you had a bully or these kinds of things in the fourth grade. You can relive those things in practice. We call this clearing. You eliminate that reflective surface out of your past, and then you can move forward without that baggage on you. In the church, they call it repentance or forgiveness. In philosophy, you know, we call that, you know, talking it out and, you know, coming to terms with it, facing your fears. But it's all the same energy. Once that energy is clean, then you can begin to move forward. Now, let's look at the future, because this is where the secret kind of missed the target. What they said is, okay, put the picture on your fridge, and then every time you go for food or milk or whatever, look at that thing, and it'll constantly, you know, be in the forefront of your mind. That I liken to ringing a bell over and over and over again. Every time you pass the bell, you smack it with a hammer. But when you're only focused on that, it's like holding on to the bell with one hand and hitting it with the hammer with the other hand. It doesn't have a chance to resonate out. Now, if you let it resonate, you know that sound is going to go out 360 degrees in every direction. And throughout time. Now, what the secret teaches you is just follow that frequency and it will lead you to your dream. That's not true. Going back to resonance theory, every single time you put an energy into the universe, all the things that will vibrate with that energy will sympathetically pick up that energy and begin vibrating. Let me give you an example. Let's say you had an acoustic guitar. And it's out of its case, and it's laying against the couch with the strings facing outward. Then you turn your stereo on and turn it up really loud. At some point in that music, one of the strings on that guitar will just bring. It'll just ring out like somebody struck it with a pick. And in actuality, what has happened is that string is picking up energy that is exactly tuned to that string and responding by vibrating and giving off its sound. The secret to the secret is to look for the things that are putting off the sound from your energy and then pour energy into those.
For example?
For example, I have three examples. One was a pro-am golfer. I asked, because all he did was play golf, but I asked him, how many attempts did it take you at amateur to go pro? How many times did you compete before it seemed like you were in the zone? Everything you hit seemed to just go right for the pin. And he thought for a minute and he said, I think it was the eighth one. I think it was the eighth pro-am. I said, really? So I asked a real estate salesman, same thing, eighth house. It was like it just fell together for them. Each time I went to these systems, to people, to events where ordinary people tried things over and over and over again, around the eighth time is when the energy that they were putting out seemed to be the most effective. That goes along with the eight iterations of the Fibonacci sequence. So these are really good examples. So if, for instance, there are three classifications of things that you can manifest. I break it down in the book. One is having, and Lord knows we're good at wanting stuff. I want a Lamborghini. I want a big house. I want. We're caught up in that. Our whole life is circled around this having. The second one is a little bit more important, and that's being. I want to be something. I want to teach. I want to paint. I want to design. I want to be something. And the third, which is probably the one we don't pay much attention to at all, is doing. Each one has its own kind of energy. But I try to encourage people, look, if you'll do the last two, if you'll do the doing and the being, the having will come. Or, even more importantly, the having won't matter. Because dying with the most toys is not the goal of life. The goal of life is to learn as much as you can, to do as much as you can, to be as much as you can, to experience the mortal existence. And by doing that, you'll have a lot more satisfaction than if you have a perfect 401k and a perfect house and two new cars, I promise you. So that's how the secret kind of bore out. And then when I put the book out, it became a bestseller. I got people wrote me all kinds of letters of how they applied the meditation I suggest in the book, which kind of helps you listen to the vibrations of the universe and focusing on doing and being instead of having.
Now, let's say you're the eighth time, you're an athlete, you're a professional, and you're in the zone. You can feel that difference when you're in the zone. Everything just comes together. It's like you're one. I always say you're one with the universe or whatever.
There you go.
But sometimes you get knocked out of that and you don't know why. Why does that happen? Can other people mess up they get jealous or they're knocking you off of your vibration without you? How does that work?
Because in the universe, there are these like fibers of resonance. We call it the fabric of space-time. We used to think it was kind of imaginary, kind of, well, it was an easy way to explain how space bends and all of that. But now we have instruments that are sensitive enough that we can actually see the fabric of space-time. We can look at quasars, which are the largest single structures in the universe, and pulsars, and they put off a lot of light, and it acts as a backlight to the darkness of space. And what we see is that the vast majority of space is filled with tiny gas particles. And those gas particles sit along these lines, these threads that go through space, and we can see the fabric of the universe. So being that, you're going from one point to another point in time or in your development, you can be on one of these threads, but there are other things on the threads, other things crossing those threads. There are other people's manifestations that may conflict with yours, especially in athletics, because you're competing with somebody for the same thing. So all of that applies. Now, you can say, well, I'm going to go for something that nobody else can do. I'm going to paint planets. Well, nobody can paint planets exactly like you, because it's your imagination, it's your thought process, and you can be very successful doing that. You can isolate yourself from what everything else is going on around you, can be successful. But great success comes from jumping on that thread and out manifesting other people. Some souls like that competition. The other thing to realize, and I explain this in the book very carefully, it works for good or for ill. If bad people understand this principle as well, and they can manifest great power and great oppression on people by using this energy to manifest their kingdoms. Why do you think one illiterate tyrant can have so much power? Because there are lots and lots of people that are aligning their consciousness with his, and it's creating this resonance in the universe.
Is there certain types of people that can resonate, and people like to follow certain types of people and resonate with them versus others? Because sometimes the best people that you really want to resonate with aren't the ones people follow.
Yeah, that's true. A case in point, Billy Graham, great man, simple, focused on one message, and probably the greatest or most successful preacher of all time. And when you listen to him, listen to the energy that he puts out in his words, you can see why stadiums full of people are moved by him, because of that energy. Now, did they follow him? Did they join his church? No. Why? Because he wasn't leading. He was just introducing them to Jesus Christ. So if we had our druthers, most people would want to follow a flawless being. I don't know any on this planet. So it's a little difficult to do. I think I observe that society as a whole is all too willing to abdicate the responsibility for their own life condition to someone else. And that puts us sometimes in a bad position.
Well, and sometimes they're willing to do that with the people that are least worthy of it. And we'll get into that later when we start talking about the Clinton crime cabal. But it seems like it's a pattern with people. And maybe is it, I mean, I don't know. Is it the ill, as you say, the evil has just as much power as the goodness? And I don't know.
It depends, you know, because the reward is physical. That is to say, it has to do with the mortal existence. For instance, if you follow the Clinton crime syndicate, you're going to be promised immunity from prosecution. You're going to be promised unearthly wealth, the wealth of kings. You're going to be promised almost to be untouchable as far as repercussions for what you want to do. Of course, the things that you must promise to do, or the things that you are convinced to do, you will hate yourself for. So yeah, you'll be successful. Yes, you'll be powerful. But you'll have no rest, because your soul will be bothered by the things that you've done.
Yeah, you can't sleep at night. I always tell myself that I'm going to behave in a way that I can sleep at night. I can feel good about everything I do. And I'm not perfect, so I can sleep pretty well. Okay, I did my best. But they can't.
The Old Testament has a way of saying this. It's not exactly like this, but it's, there is no rest for the wicked. The way that it says it is basically, the dogs of your sins will chase you all the days of your life. You'll be constantly on the move, constantly not at rest. You'll never be satisfied with anything in life. So you'll constantly be driving for more and more and more. If you're
wicked. Excellent. That's really good, looking at it. Well, let's get into, you have done some amazing work here. You did another book called The Arc of, a series, I guess, The Arc of Millions of Years, New Discoveries in Light on the Creation. And I the foreword of one of those books talks about what got you into that. Can you explain that, how you got into this, and then what it's about?
Sure. I actually met my co-author at a lecture. I was giving a lecture on the speed of light or something. It was all age groups. And she came up to me afterwards. She said, I have an idea for a book. I said, oh, that's nice. And she said, well, it's on the creation of the earth. I went, really? Tell me more. So she started to show me. She was an archaeologist. She started to show me shapes and things from Babylonians and the Mayans and the Olmecs. And I said, well, I know what that shape is. I know what that is. I know. She said, well, what are they? I said, well, this represents the Milky Way galaxy, and this looks like a particle accelerator. And she said, but this stuff's 5,000 years old. Well, that caught my attention. So we decided to write The Ark of Millions of Years, which was the first volume. And it turned out to be 1,000 pages. So the publisher said, no. You cannot publish a 1,000-page book. Cut it down. So we cut it down to 560 pages. It had hundreds of pictures that we took and drawings, and it took a view of the ancients that I don't think anyone had been taking at that time, and it was relative to the advent of 2012, but this was written in 2004. The reason we put the grand sextile planetary alignment on the cover is because the day that we published the book, we knew was going to be the sixth planet alignment in the heavens. So we put that alignment on the cover. We published it in, I think it was November of 2004. And I thought, her name is E.J. Clark. I said, E.J., we're authors. We did it. You buy five copies, I'll buy five copies, and it'll be awesome.
At least we'll sell 10.
So I had an interview on Coast to Coast AM. They called me up and said, hey, we want an interview about this book. I said, really? So I felt like I'd been put on, you know, the pitcher's mound at Yankee Stadium as a rookie. But that interview changed everything. That's what I'm talking about, listening to the universe, accepting those key things that are vibrating with the energy that you put out there. Wrote a book and changed the world, because we wrote three more books, 2,000 pages worth, about this progression of the ancients, because these 44 civilizations that we looked at invested enormous amounts of their gross national product, labor, stone, architecture, planning like you could not believe, not for their day, for our day. They were building something that we in the 21st century or 20th century would look at and say, how did they do that? Why did they do that? And those two questions stimulated this remembrance of who we are as a race. And it changed a lot of the direction that we were going in. In fact, in 1776, when they were looking across the wilderness of America, trying to put 13 ragtag colonies together and revolt, they went to plan a city. Well, they didn't plan it like, hey, there's a hill over there and here's a valley here. They laid the city out according to ancient patterns, which were known way before the Freemasons, before back to the temple builders of Tyre, which are the group that Solomon went to ask them to build the temple because God had assigned him to build the temple. He didn't know a thing about building temples. That's how far back this technology goes. Why did they do that? Because they knew the resonance with these ancient patterns that had been set down over the millennia were important to the longevity of a nation. And we're just now beginning to understand it. In physics, we're just now realizing there aren't, the great forces in the universe, gravity, electromagnetism, and the small and weak and strong molecular forces. We thought there were four forces in the universe. There aren't. There are five. And the fifth is consciousness. And I was communicating with Sir Roger Penrose many years ago, And he wrote that consciousness was the result of quantum gravity. We were considering quantum gravity in those days. And I said, I beg to differ with you. I think quantum gravity is the result of consciousness, which means consciousness is involved in the creation process of the universe. And the creation is still ongoing.
It's just amazing because it's hard for us to get our head around all this stuff, right? We're just learning it. And if we're just learning it now when you're middle age, it's much harder to versus if you learned it when you're a kid. But
well, imagine if we taught it to kids.
Yeah, we don't. But what are some of the main things that you got out of that series that you wrote? Because I think one of the most mind-expanding things we can do is understand the ancients. And our history, we're just starting to understand our history. And it's amazing. Well, there's much more to us than what we've been told.
Well, one of the things that we realize about history as early as writing could be done is that history is written by the victors. It's not really real history. It's what's, you know, taken out of the ashes and put together by the people who survived. So it's up to the human consciousness to kind of go back themselves into those days within your meditation and experience what it was really like. What was living in ancient Rome really like? What was it like in Teotihuacan when the migrants who were being driven by horrible storms from the East Coast, driven inland by these terrible hurricanes that were lashing the coast, they come up over the mountains and down into a valley. And there's this city, Teotihuacan, all alabaster, white, totally straight, aligned with the stars, huge complex, and totally abandoned. No writing, no pictures, no nothing. Irrigation systems, they didn't know who built it. They just moved in and took it over. And I've been there. I've walked those streets. You could see the two civilizations come together. History doesn't teach us that. History teaches us that the Mayans built that. History teaches us the Egyptians built the Great Pyramid of Giza. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. That pyramid is 5,000 years older than Egypt itself. When the Egyptians walked into the Nile River Valley, those pyramids were sitting there. And they tried for thousands of years to copy them and couldn't.
Yeah, because they're so amazing. I mean, we still can't do a lot of that stuff. So what did you learn? Did you learn that we were much more advanced in the past and maybe had cycles of advanced civilization and we got wiped out? And then, you know, like they're saying, we have amnesia, or was there something else?
No, you're exactly right. What we found were evidence after evidence, whether I went to Tibet, I've been to China, Mexico, Japan, no matter where we went, we saw modern man, I guess, our history goes back 8, maybe 9,000 years, and then it gets pretty primitive. And then there's a huge gap, and you get back around 200,000-300,000 years, there's another zenith. You go back 1 million years, 5 million years, there's another zenith. Tools and jewelry and all kinds of things exhumed out of sediments we already know are, you know, 50 million years old. And yet, here's a man-made artifact. Where did that civilization of man go? And we don't know the answer to that because that history is all gone. There were no survivors from it. Whoever did survive were not the people that could record history. We're kind of like that today. I mean, if we were hit with a terrible calamity, a plague or a comet or whatever, and it wiped out 90% of the population, it's highly doubtful that the 10% that would survive are the smart guys. Probably the 10% that survive are the strong guys, and they're not going to record history.
That's really interesting. And do you think that, because we have a little bit of history, we have some drawings of advanced, you know, physics, and you were saying that these guys were building things so that we would know later. So do you think there was a time where there were a civilization of people that said, okay, we were wiped out once, And there's enough of us that we can document this for our future humans.
You bring up a really good point. Let me make it answer it two ways. One is that all 44 of these ancient civilizations that we studied believe that the soul is eternal. It's immortal. That is to say, it can be born mortally over and over again. So at some point, as they were getting visions of what was going to happen around 2012, they realized that in order for man to survive that, we needed to be awakened. We needed heads up. We needed to prepare. So thousands of years ago, what they built were things that would weather whatever the earth could throw at it, them being wiped out, but that would stay. And that way, when they're born in the future, 2,000 or 3,000 years in the future, they would see these things that they built 3,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, and say, I remember what this means. Somehow, you know, it's, I'm not going to have the same language. I'm not going to have, you know, the same concepts of communication 5,000 years from now, but I'm going to leave something that makes even the most intelligent of us go, how did they do that? And they're going to start thinking about it and examining it, and then they're going to awaken, and it's going to save the race of mankind. This is why all those civilizations weren't looking for their day. They were investing in our day. Why, if they're not going to be around? Because they were going to be around. It's us.
And is it also because they knew it was so traumatic and that they had to struggle to learn it? Or, I mean, it's hard to know, right?
That's also a good question, because in almost every civilization, they record meeting what they call the Shining Ones. There are 9 specific civilizations that actually did call them the Shining Ones. They came and taught them things like animal husbandry, the movement of the stars, cleanliness, irrigation, how to deliver babies and how to, you know, survive. And these beings kind of taught mankind how to win over the wilderness of the earth, which is, I'm afraid, you can go about 20, maybe 25,000 light years in every single direction. There's no planet like Earth. There's no rock in space with the plethora of life that this planet has. This is an extremely rare event in space, this Earth. And by the way, the first book in the second chapter talks about a concept which we carry forward. Yeah, I even carried it forward through the Birth Trilogy. And that is called the union of the polarity, that living planets are made of temporal matter, third dimensional matter, and spirit matter, a higher dimensional matter, put together, just like we are. I'm this physical thing you see on YouTube, but I'm also this leaping, flying being inside of here. I'm 2 forms of energy occupying the same space at the same time. And one day, I hope a long time from now, they're going to come apart. The physical one is going to go back to the earth. The spiritual one is going to go on to the next whatever. Same thing with planets. And sometime, very soon, these 2 planets are going to become dissonant to one another, and they're going to separate. One higher planet going back to where it came from through the rift in the Milky Way galaxy, and the other one staying here around a main sequence sun on the rim of the Milky Way galaxy.
Well, let me ask you, there's been some, I talked to a Vatican translator who had, he translated 17 books, and he was looking at the Old Testament, and he was saying that that really was a description of human cloning. And when you actually look at the original, his name is Biglino. Mauro Biglino, I need to say his name. When you look at the original documents that he translated it from, it's talking about human cloning and all these other things, and it's not really what people think it is. Have you heard that, and how does that intertwine with your research?
Because in the book of Genesis, you really have two creations. In the first creation, God, or the creator, says, all right, I'm going to put man and woman on the earth, command them to multiply and to till the earth, and that's it. The second creation, which takes place right after that, takes place in a completely separate place. We call this the planet Eden. It's its own world. Only one person is put on this world. It's all animals, and one man is put on this world. Now, a lot of people think about the days of creation as being days, but even more people think about it as being a long period of time. Let's say 1,000 years. So Adam is created out of the stuff of the earth, all the genetic material that's available on the earth. He makes Adam, dirt, and breathes life into him. That is to say, puts a spirit into him. But he lives on this planet for almost an entire creative period, 1,000 years. And at the end of it, they put him to sleep, take a rib, and create a mate for him. Now, why didn't they just make another woman from dirt? Because had to have something genetically compatible with him. Adam couldn't breed with any of the animals on the earth. No animal can breed with another species. It has to come from that exact species. Now, here's the peculiar thing about Eve that I maintain, and I'm having a hard time believing an argument against this. Adam did not have a belly button. He was a constructed being. Eve did have a belly button, because to clone, you have to take the genetic material, create a zygote, put it into the womb of an existing being, and then let it go through the fetal period and be born. So it's born a newborn, raised up as a little girl to a full mature woman, which probably took 30 years, 25, 30 years, and then she was brought back to the planet Eden and given to Adam at the end of that period of time. Now, you can say whatever you want about the corruption in the seventh day when God left and left them to their own designs with the serpent. But the bottom line is that Eden was then transferred once their physical makeup changed. They could no longer survive on Eden. Eden was moved from where it was in space to here, and the two planets were put together, and the cataclysm was horrendous. It tore both planets up for months and months and months. And when the dust settled, when the water settled, what we had was Earth, a combination of the original man and woman DNA and Adam and Eve's DNA. And over the millennia, those two DNA have become one. We've amalgamated into one another. And some of these markers, these genetic markers for tribes who have not married or not had children outside their tribe, these genetic markers are very unique. They're unique on the earth. There's a project out there called 23andMe. Somebody had the idea, you know what we really need to do to understand this? We have to sample everybody's DNA. But how can we get them to do that? We can't force them into a shoots and take samples from them. So they sell it, and they make people pay for own DNA. Well, it's wonderful to get your chart back, but they're getting something too. They're profiling mankind.
Well, the other thing that Morrow said was that there were labs all over the world, and that one was Eden, but there were other ones too. And maybe that's labs
describe,
elsewhere?
Describe world. I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, Eden was here on Earth somewhere. But you recall that during the creative period, there was no sun, there was no moon, there was no rain, there was no sea. It was just the garden. The periods of night and day didn't occur till the third day. It
How long ago do you think that was?
That's a good question. In the book, The Original Arc of Millions of Years, we know that part of this Earth is 4.5 billion years old. But we also know that there's a component of this world that's only about 6 or 7,000 years old. So we purport in the book that somewhere around 3800 BC is when the two worlds came together.
So that's part of the cataclysm and wiping out civilizations.
Right.
That maybe two planets hit each other or something. That very interesting. And of course, there's a lot more to learn, right? Because we only look back at the past for what we have, and we keep uncovering things.
Yeah. And of course, this is the time during which material was coming to me describing a hollow Earth, which I summarily threw out. I mean, I didn't even consider it. I put it on the bookshelf and didn't think about it for years. But then NASA started getting involved. Then JPL started getting involved. Then EUMETSAT started getting involved. And I said, hey, wait a minute. How come they're spending all this money to understand something I thought we already knew? And what answers are they getting? Well, it turned out the answers didn't support the old school idea of planetary core geology. Now, it doesn't say that the Earth is hollow, but it says there's a lot of questions about the assumption that we live on a molten ball floating through space on cool tectonic plates like cornflakes in a bowl of milk. That model doesn't hold water anymore.
Well, I know the electric universe theory, they think their model is saying that there's a hollow center. And I know there's another, and I don't know the name. Oh, that was Walt Thornhill that told me about it in a video. But there's another person from out of Africa, and I don't know his name, that had put some waves through the Earth, and it came out the other side, which would not happen if we had a solid core. So there's a lot of evidence now saying, wait a minute, there's something here.
Well, it really started shaking loose. I think it was 2010. Dr. Y Sessions with Washington University, he commissioned 600,000 seismograms, these printouts that are done by seismic listening stations around the planet. Whenever there's on a globe, if you have a really strong earthquake over here, it vibrates through the whole planet. So the other listening stations around the planet pick up those vibrations. And they can, with proper analysis, kind of do a CAT scan of the Earth, because these vibrations arrive at different times. Well, that data had never been analyzed. It had never been treated in this way. So Y Sessions and his grad students tackled 600,000 of these events, these earthquake events. And what they discovered was another ocean crashing against a shore underneath the crust, at least as big as the Atlantic Ocean. This is real science, real measurement, real independent, not human observation. This is instrumental observation that says there's another ocean on the inside of the planet.
Well, the interesting thing is how warm, how cold is it? Can it have life? And other stories or questions.
I can say this. If there is space inside the planet, there will be life there. It may be extremophoric, but there will be life there. But the fact that water is liquid and it's crashing against the shore means it's somewhere between freezing and boiling, which means life can exist. Then the observations that were made once at one university and then at another university, and I'll tell you the differences between the two. They wanted to measure the resonant frequency of the core of the Earth. They wanted to know, because we do this, is called spectroscopy. Every single molecular bond is like a little guitar string. It has a certain note. We know the distance between the hydrogen atoms and the nucleus of every single molecule on the periodic chart. So we can tell what's iron and what's titanium and what's calcium just by the frequency that it resonates with. Turns out the core of the Earth is almost completely 100% iron, and it's crystalline in nature. The molecular structure that it makes up the core of the earth is very highly pressurized, very high temperature crystalline iron. Now, the first university reported that the temperature of this core was somewhere around 5,000 degrees C. Well, if you're a physicist or a chemist, I have a degree in chemistry, you realize that those two numbers don't make sense. It won't resonate at that light frequency at 5,000 degrees. So they needed to take another look at it. They needed another way of examining it. So the second university did the measurement again, only this time they took a sample, which they created, put it in a lab, and then put it in an anvil press, and they pressed it to what they thought was the pressure that was making up this core of the earth. And this time they took it to 6,000 degrees C. And that is the correct temperature, which is the temperature of the surface of the sun, which means that this iron crystal, which is probably somewhere around 1,200 miles in diameter, is putting off a white light. Now, it's not fusion light, not shortwave light like you see coming from the sun. It's iron light. It can grow plants, but it doesn't promote what's called protein dimerization, which is what the ultraviolet wavelengths do to DNA.
You know what's so fascinating about that? Wallace Thornhill explained that the gravity, you know, the gravity keeps us on the earth spinning, so it goes this way, but it also goes out, right?
Yeah.
And so that means that the inside of the thing, you'd be standing on the inside. So if there's a light coming, it would look the same that we are experiencing here on Earth, but inside.
It would look a little different.
But you know what? You know what I'm saying? It wouldn't be. It would be, obviously, it'd be a little different because it is different, but it would have a phenomena that was similar. If what you're saying is true with the core and putting out a light.
Well, let's look at it from Newton's point of view, motion of planets. We know that the time it takes for the Earth to go around the sun, we know the distance from the Earth to the sun. And by those two things, we can calculate what the weight of Earth would be. Now, in order for the Earth to be where it is and be going as fast as it is around the sun, it would have to have a certain density. The problem is that the Earth is much more dense than what that formula would support if it were solid all the way through or molten all the way through.
Yeah, that's why they're coming back and saying it's more than likely hollow.
Yeah, and by hollow, I mean that the crust itself is probably around 800 or 900 miles thick. Now, we've only drilled 8 miles into it, so we don't really know much about the crust. But these MRIs that we're doing, or these CAT scans that we're doing, are telling us how thick this crust is. Then there's about a 600 or 700 mile air gap, and then the core. Now, our atmosphere on the surface is only about 8 miles. That's it. At 40,000 feet, it's so thin, it'll support an airplane going 500 miles an hour, but it won't support life. Inside the planet, with the atmosphere that thick, without vacuum, there's no space, you have insulation between the core and the inside of the crust. You also have no nighttime, no stars, probably no rain. There's no weather. It's a temperature equilibrium. So you have a completely different ecosphere than you have on the surface. And I would say if the ancients are correct and some of these races escaped the cataclysms of the surface by going inside the planet, they can't come to the surface anymore, not without shelter.
So is there a belief that there is a race that's in the inside that's been there for a long time?
There are lots of beliefs like that. Almost every ancient civilization believes that the original life force came from inside the planet.
That's so incredible. It's so incredible. Now, you have a mission to go start figuring this out. You have a lot of universities. You have all sorts of people on board wanting to figure this out. Can you explain that a little bit?
I after the sand began to tilt the balance a little bit, I became interested in knowing if there was an expedition anywhere, somewhere, to see if any of this stuff is true. This is before a lot of the satellite information was really coming back. And there was. It was being run out of Oregon, I think. So his name was Stephen Curry, and he'd led several expeditions that are pretty wild like this, different places. So I joined the expedition. That was in, I think, November. By August or by July, he was dead. He died of rapid onset brain cancer. So I thought, well, that was good while it lasted. And then in October of that year, the board called me and said, you do big projects all the time. Why don't you take over as expedition leader? I said, well, let me think about it. I have a lot on my plate. But by Christmas, I said, I'll do it. But we're going to have to do this a little differently. We're not going to sell seats on the boat because all we're going to get is a bunch of rich tourists and we're not going to really accomplish anything. If I lead this, we're going to have to do this purely scientific, which means we develop a hypothesis, we design experiments, we put a team together, raise the money, and go do it. We got all of that done except for the raise the money part. Because in 2008, when we went to the market to try to raise the money, at that time it was, I think, a $1.5 million expedition. The economy had something else in mind. 2008 was the worst year that I can remember for investment money. And it just never recovered. We tried every summer from then until probably 2010. So quite a long time, probably six and a half, seven years we tried to put this together. All kinds of different ways. We shot a pilot film. We entered that pilot film into a contest of scientific projects on Nippon Television Network in Japan. We won first place with our film. We had 17 million Japanese watch our film in one night. That was phenomenal. But the money to do it just wouldn't gel, which kind of led me to believe that maybe we're focused on the wrong thing because the universe just wasn't resonating with it. So years have gone by and I've done other things, of course, but I never really quit on it. I did resign from the expedition, I think, 2.5 years ago, but I have now opened a conversation with Netflix. We originally thought, well, let's do a big screen documentary, you know, like The March of the Penguins or something, and it'll be great. People will like it. There was just no way to attract an investor that way because it's $6-7 million to put a big screen movie together and get it out in a number of theaters, and it's 7 to 8 years to get that done. Well, along comes digital technology, and one of the great technologists in that business is John Gress. He holds the patent on a lot of this technology, small screen digitization using virtually a completely CGI movie with real people. And now we're putting together a 13-piece miniseries for Netflix. I have signed the contracts. I cannot publish a book on this, but I can speak about it. And so hopefully that will get funded, and we'll take all the research that I've done from 2004 until now, which is substantial, and we'll put it into the first 13 pieces of that miniseries. At the end of that season, if the advertising and the response is there, which I believe it will be, the second year we're going to do the actual trip to the Arctic, which now costs about $3.5 million. They have built a new ship called the Arctica, which is bigger, faster, and it's brand spanking new, and it can make this trip. It can break through 2.5 meters of ice for days and days and days if that's what it takes to get there.
Wow, that's an incredible deal that you're doing. Now, how would you say it relates to some of the activities that are going on in Antarctica? Because a lot of the leaders have visited down there, and they've done it at strange times, like Kerry going down there right the day of the election and just weird things. What's really going on down there, or have you been following that? How does that relate to your project?
Well, the Antarctic is an enormous operation. It's been going since the late 40s. And now there are 99 countries that are invested in that. And every year, the purview over the project changes from country to country. Of course, it's the main countries. And so all the exploration, everything is coordinated through one country. It's kind of, I don't want to say a UN project, but it's kind of a united project down there in Antarctica. The thing that gets everybody is there is a tourist aspect to this, but you get to see what they want you to see. You get to see the penguins, and you maybe make a couple of jaunts along the shore and have lunch, and 2 days later you get on a plane and you fly out. Antarctica is the largest continent on the planet, and there's so much going on there. It's unbelievable. To get to those things, you have to either be affiliated, which means with the university or with the Polar Research Foundation, which is part of the National Science Foundation, or you have to be part of the military. There is no tourist aspect to that. You can't get on a C-130 and fly into the outback of Antarctica and see what they're doing. I do find it most strange that world leaders, Kerry and members of high-ranking members of the Vatican and all kinds of people go down there and have gone down there in the strangest times. And it seems like they're learning something down there that is giving them secrets. Now, in the Birth Trilogy, I maintain that ancient intelligence that's teaching the Syndicate how to do what it does has been here for thousands of years. I personalize it and make it a Nephilim, which I don't think there's ever been a movie with a Nephilim in it, unless you want to consider the latest Star Wars. But because Snoke's, it does look like a Nephilim. But I name him. I use his name right out of the Old Testament, and he is incorporated in the book. So if you had an ancient intelligence like that on the Earth, where would it be? Where would it hide? A great place to put it would be Antarctica. The Arctic is a completely different dynamic. It freezes, it thaws, it's highly trafficked, a lot of plane traffic, a lot of ship traffic. But there are regions that have never been seen from the surface. No one's ever sailed it.
And that's where you're going to go.
That's where we're going to go. And in fact, getting to the Murmansk Shipping Company was a chore because no shipping company has the capability of going there except them. It's their territory, but they don't go there.
Why did you pick that area versus any other area to do this research?
That's a good question. Mostly, it's not scientific. It's kind of a process of elimination as far as that being scientific, but most of it is from the legend itself. When we go to ancient maritime records, when wooden ships would sail from Europe to the American continent, they would sail close to this route, and they would typically sail in groups of two or sometimes three ships. But they don't sail close to one another. They sail like 8 miles apart. That way they don't run into each other in the fog. And one of the things that they consistently record in their records is there's a period of about a day when one of the ships will disappear. And then it will reappear a day later. It's on course. It's following the same stars. But it seems to dip down in the sea. And it doesn't come back up till the next day. And I interviewed a rear admiral and asked him about this oceanic depression. And he said, it absolutely exists. It absolutely exists. I said, so what's your explanation? Why do you think it is? He said, well, I think it's areas on the planet where like gravity is more intense and it pulls the water down. And maybe that's why we kind of sail down into a sea valley and then sail up the other side. And I said, well, let me propose another idea to you. What if that's an area of the planet where gravity is very low and the surrounding gravity is pulling the water away from that area? He said, I never thought about that, but that makes sense. The problem is that the ocean in this area where it happens is 4,000 meters deep. We just don't know. We don't know what's on the bottom. We don't know if there's an opening into the inner earth there. We don't know if they're close to it and then the rest of it's under the ice. We just don't know.
So but you're gonna go there and figure that what that is.
Yep.
And then from there you're gonna go from whatever you figure out.
Well, there's three aspects about this, and it might sound a little unscientific, but it is actually scientific. One is that if there are two oceans, one on the inside, one on the outside, and there's a vent between the two, then the water is going to be different right there. It's going to have different crystallinity, different microbes, different salinity, because it's in a different environment and they're mixing. Now, by the time it gets away from there 100 miles, it's pretty dilute and difficult to follow. That's one. The second is there are probably going to be strong magnetic anomalies there. We're going to be able to measure those as we go into it. So all those instruments are coming. Air measurements, electric measurements, magnetic measures. My own ancestor, Sir James Ross, discovered the North Magnetic Pole in 1831. So this instrumentation does exist. The third is a little more esoteric, and that is no matter where we do our research, we run into scientists and let's just call them spiritualists who believe that there is a dimensional aspect to this as well. That if you're not of the right consciousness or intent, you're not going to see anything. It's masked to you. So what we want to do on this 15-day journey with these scientists, film crew, and our trainers is to get the consciousness of the people on that ship to a certain point using meditation, different techniques that we know, lights and sound and things like this. We think that if we get that ship in that remote place, 300 miles from the next brain, no human consciousness anywhere around, we will make a consciousness beacon in that area. And if there is intelligent life living on the bottom or inside the planet, they will come to us. And when they do, we'll get it on film.
That would be incredible. Well, I'm definitely going to follow that.
That would change the world. And you can't. It's a difficult thing to do for us, but satellites come over, and what we're going to do is pack the video, upload it, and then download it to two continents. So about every 2 hours, we can make an upload. So it will be almost real time.